Good morning and welcome. We're going to try to get started here. I know that many of you have tales of harrowing experiences like my own on the metro this morning, so we'll put that behind us and focus on the topic before us today, which is selling peace in Sudan. The question that we'll be addressing is how can the provisions of a peace agreement be disseminated to a public that lives either in isolated villages under threat of attack or in refugee camps in other countries? And how can public opinion be gauged, and how can a constituency to support a peace agreement be constructed? And it's probably not surprising that information is a challenge within Darfur itself. There's an article in this morning's Washington Post that talks about the problem of just disseminating information about the Darfur conflict within the United States. This evening there will be an HBO documentary called Sand and Sorrow, on which George Clooney, who's the moderator and reportedly, as you all know, the sexiest man in the world, will quote a study done which he says indicates that during 2004, the NBC devoted 130 minutes to covering Martha Stewart and only 4 minutes to covering the Darfur conflict. So if that's even moderately the case, there's a real problem. Our speaker this morning, Simon Hayslock, is probably the best qualified person any of us know to talk about this subject. If you look at Simon's bio, and it's available on the table outside, you'll see that his biography is the history of the role of media in post-conflict intervention starting in the Balkans and going through Iraq. And currently he has been involved in advising the African Union mission in Sudan on how to explain the Darfur peace process to Darfurians and to build local ownership for the peace settlement when it comes. So we're very grateful that you're here this morning.
Thank you very much.
And it's very nice to see you again and welcome you back to USIP. We're here for about the next hour and a little bit more. We have great pressure on this room, so we'll be curtailing about 11:15, a little after. I will turn the floor over to Simon, and then when he's completed his remarks, we'll open the floor for comments and questions. So go ahead, please. Welcome.
Thank you very much. I'll try to talk for perhaps just a little over half an hour, and then the rest of the time take questions, because I think it's probably better to get at the things that you're interested in rather than the things that I might be interested in talking about, which may be different. I think it's interesting when we look at the title of this, to say selling peace in Sudan. And clearly you don't need to sell peace in Sudan. I mean, the Sudanese and the Darfurians specifically, that's what they want. I mean, they don't need to be told that that's what they want. And secondly, it encapsulates one of the problems, one of the notions which go to the heart of the great debate at the moment about public diplomacy, strategic communications at the sort of central level, is, you know, are you actually trying to sell something, or are you just trying to create some form of debate which includes the people that you're actually targeting so that they take some form of possession and ownership over the process themselves rather than being preached to from outside? So the first point I would make is that when we went to Darfur, we as a team were asked essentially by the Foreign Office, the British Foreign Office, to go to support the African Union to sell and proselytize the Darfur Peace Agreement as it was immediately after it had been signed in Abuja in May of last year. By the time we actually got on the ground, there was quite a large gap between the signing of the agreement and the time people actually started to try and explain it. And to a certain extent, the damage had already been done. One, the peace agreement, as you know, was only signed up to by essentially one of the protagonists, not including the government. And in the time since then, those groups have fractured from three principal groupings to over 20. Which has made the problem much more complicated in terms of how you talk to the movement. And in the time before anybody tried to explain what was in the peace agreement in any meaningful sense, Abdul Wahid, the principal representative of the FUR, which is the largest tribal grouping in Darfur, had essentially already made his points much more effectively to his constituency than the people in favour of the peace agreement as it stood had an opportunity to do so. And it's quite interesting how he did that, and we can perhaps talk about that in terms of technical things later. But our problem became not how do we sell a peace agreement, because to a certain extent it was already in the doldrums. It was a question of how do we actually create a debate so people actually know what the talk we're talking about. And so the essential problem we were confronted with was how to explain a peace process as opposed to a peace agreement against the background of this already unpopular peace agreement itself, the DPA, in a situation where most Darfurians have no access to newspapers, and even if they did, only a fairly small percentage of them can read. There is no television, or very little, except in the principal cities. Limited radio, and radio is a subject which we can talk about more because it's interesting, because it provokes a lot of discussion. And as I said already, where only few can read. So as I said, what our main issue was how do we actually approach this. There was no point in talking about the Darfur peace agreement, because as many people tried to tell us, particularly in the NGO community, that to actually go into some of the IDP camps to explain the peace agreement would immediately put you into danger, that actually even mentioning the Darfur peace agreement in some of the camps was dangerous. And so clearly what we needed to do was to, if you want to use conventional marketing methodology, is to rebrand the DPA. You know, we needed to find some way of discussing the subject without actually mentioning it specifically, but bringing people to discuss the issues of it through another mechanism. And so we realized immediately that this wasn't something that we could do by conventional public information techniques, by the international community through the aegis of the African Union, explaining things to people. We need to find mechanisms which enabled the local community to discuss it for themselves and to take ownership of the process. One of the problems that you have to consider as well is that the conduits, if you're using the international community, were broadly not trusted. The signatories of the DPA were obviously the government of Sudan, and the government of Sudan, as we know, is certainly not trusted by the vast majority of people in Darfur who were affected by the conflict. The African Union, for reasons which we can discuss, AMIS, had not got a good reputation within Darfur as far as Darfurians are concerned. And there is a problem in terms of actually making sure that the international community generally understood the extent of the problem that they were confronting. So, you know, we wanted to create ownership, we wanted to build confidence in the process in order to get people to buy into an internationally led process, and that meant building confidence in the implementers, and we needed to maintain international engagement and get them to consider the debate more effectively. I want to talk a bit about the implementation process, first of all, because that applies a lot to where we are now and where the situation is. And having spent a lot of time in Bosnia, I think there are a lot of comparisons to be drawn between the situation in Darfur and the situation in Bosnia. Not talking about the specifics of the circumstances, but the way the international community addressed it. UNPROFOR was a force which was interposed largely as a minimalist reaction to assuage a lot of public opinion, you can argue. It never had a very, very effective mandate, and that mandate crept as people became more and more concerned about it. And it was essentially about providing humanitarian assistance. And it wasn't really until after Dayton that there was any really meaningful mechanism by which the international community could intervene and have any real impact. The African Union and AMIS has come in for a lot of criticism, which I have come to think is unfair. And you just have to examine the context in which it's been given or has taken on the mandate. And I think the comparison with Bosnia is then also interesting. In Bosnia, after Dayton, after the peace agreement, in a country the size of Belgium, a population of 4 million or so, less than that, NATO interposed 50,000 troops, four divisions equipped to the highest specifications of NATO technology. And in Darfur, a country the size of Texas, African Union forces less than 7,000. It's never managed to reach 7,000. And it was basically given a mandate initially to monitor a ceasefire agreement. So the protection force was essentially there to protect monitors who were monitoring a ceasefire. And as the situation deteriorated, they took on more and more responsibility vis-a-vis heading towards a peacekeeping notion. And the latest concept of operations a year or so ago, at the same time of the peace agreement, envisaged more overt protection of civilians and envisaged an increased force, even within the African Union context, of 12,000 troops. They've never been able to raise the number of troops from the existing sort of slightly under 7,000 to 12,000 during the time that they've been there. Not only that, in order to maintain the ceasefire, to monitor the, to protect the monitors, they've had to have a lot of small locations which have been deployed across Darfur. So that means, from a military point of view, that you have lots of places that you have to guard. And if you just take a sort of straight watch system, if you think that you have a third of your people guarding your bases, you have a third of your people off watch and sleeping, and you have a third of your people therefore able to go out on the ground and patrol, you very quickly see that at any one time in Darfur, it's unlikely that there are more than 1,500 soldiers actually patrolling the ground. And so if you start looking at the extent of the problem, you realize that they are confronted with a situation which has been grossly unfair for them to be expected to have dealt with. And at the same time, they've been subject to a diplomatic position where they need to reinforce the notion that the African Union has failed in order to justify, you know, another intervention. So at the time that we were asked to go in and to assist the African Union build its credibility and to support the peace agreement, the very same organizations that were funding us, if you like, who were supporting our activity, their job was to try and persuade everybody that the African Union needed to be replaced. I mean, and for good reasons, but you can imagine that this is a problem. How do we actually explain to Darfurians that they should have trust and confidence in the implementers, where the overall rhetoric was that they were not doing the job and they needed to be replaced by a UN or a bigger international force? So it was and is quite a conundrum. Secondly, of course, when you look at public affairs and you look at the context where people have been discussing it at the moment, is that public affairs is seen as a mechanism which is either done well or badly, and that, you know, whatever the policy is, whatever the agreement is, that you then have to go and use various techniques to explain, to sell it, etc. And the problem, of course, with that is that if the product is bad or not accepted, no matter how good you are at selling it, it becomes a problem. I mean, it's a classic marketing, you know, position. If you want to sell toothpaste, you know, you can get a marketing company to sell toothpaste by launching it in the first place. Everybody will get everybody to go out and buy it. But if your teeth then fall out when you start using it, you know, no amount of good publicity and good marketing is going to get people to buy that toothpaste. And so it's the same with international operations. If you have an agreement or a process which is clearly not having an impact on the ground, and the people who are most affected by it see no tangible results, and in fact see the situation getting worse, it's extremely difficult to explain to them that it is good for them. So we had to move into a completely different position, and that was generally accepted, that what we should be doing is actually trying to create a feeling of ownership and inclusiveness within Darfur for a peace process which is yet uncompleted, and that the DPA was part of that but not exclusively the end. Now that took some time because, again, the international community was presented with a dilemma, because if you have a peace agreement which one of the movements has signed up to and you intend therefore to go forward and implement it on that basis, to then turn around and say that it's actually open for negotiation again, it's pretty hard on the guy who's signed it. And so you're presented with a dilemma. At what stage do you actually turn around to the guy who signed it and who's actually been given positions within the new government structure within Darfur, that actually he did the wrong thing? And you are making concessions to the people who stood against the peace agreement. So that has taken some time to actually be developed as the only way to go forward. But we are now in a situation where people accept generally that the Darfur peace agreement as an entity, whilst is still relevant and contains a lot of good things in about it, it's not a question of starting again. It's a question of developing additions, addendas, appendices to it, which deal with the specific issues which the others are not concerned about. We're concerned about in the first place. And we have at the moment the CERT process, which started certainly visually badly, in the sense that very few of the movements actually turned up to the talks. But it seems now to be back on its feet, in the sense that having used that as an initiative to get the process restarted, many of the groups now seem to be talking at least about whether they should participate in the process going forward and where that process might reconvene. And so there are some hopes at the moment that things might improve. As far as the UN force is concerned, of course, that is confronted with the problems that the UN often is confronted with, that in the end, that force is predicated upon the troops who are prepared to contribute to it, and also to the sovereign position of the country which is receiving those forces. And at the moment, there's a problem in generating the force in accordance with the standards which the UN lay down that all units should have before they go to join a UN force. And there are also disagreements with the government of Sudan, significant disagreements about where those troops should be come from. And the resolution, for those of you who read it, will see that the resolution talks about that the force should be African in nature, and that is interpreted by the government of Sudan to mean exclusively African, and by the UN to mean as African as it can be. There are, at the moment, significant problems in trying to raise that force, which is considered to need troops from other countries in order to give it some of the technical and the more rigorous capacity that it needs, like helicopters, like communications, etc. So we are in a difficult situation, but there is hope, certainly as far as the peace agreement is concerned. Anyway, to return to the matters of the moment, how do you actually deal with a problem and talk to a group of people who are not normally susceptible to the normal links that the media might have to them? Well, we have done a number of things, and I think it's interesting that people should look back when they think about how people get their information as to how ordinary people in any society get their information. Nobody gets their information from a single silver bullet, and it's interesting when you're talking to members of the international community, to diplomats who are talking about, we need to do this or we need to do that, they are always examining what is going to be the single thing, be it a television station, be it a radio project or whatever, that's going to be the silver bullet which manages to communicate your message. And I've seen this in a number of places, not just in Darfur, because that's not the case. And if you analyse for a moment how you get your own information, what you do is you might read about it or you might hear it first from somewhere. And it doesn't actually start to formulate as a concept that you trust in your mind until you've perhaps confirmed it from another source or you've discussed it with your friends. The other day, I mean, I was talking to somebody in a bar about what's happening in Fallujah at the moment. You know, is this surge actually working? You know, are there indications that... although I'd read it in a couple of places, my mind is not going to decide until I've discussed and taken other advice from other people. Now, this is the same in Darfur. People are not going to get their information from one source. They are going to take it from a number of sources, and then they're going to discuss it amongst themselves within their traditional structures. And once they have done that, they will formulate their opinion. But, of course, the way they get their information is very different from you and I, and they have a very hierarchical system, you need to engage with that. But at the same time, the conventional mechanisms that we all use do work in that context, because many of the elites and many of the people who are at the pinnacle or at the top of that structure clearly, you know, read newspapers, clearly listen to the radio, clearly talk to people, and so those mechanisms all do have relevance. So you need to use a very large arsenal of methods to disseminate the sorts of messages and information that you need to generate this public debate. But I do want to reinforce again that we are talking here about creating debate and ownership, not about necessarily convincing people, because they need, in order for the peace process as it is developing now, in order for it to work, it needs to be seen as something that is owned and possessed by Darfurians, not preached to, as I said at the beginning. So how do we actually do that? First of all, we have created a newspaper. Some people say, why have you created a newspaper in an environment where only 75% of the people probably are illiterate? Well, I've explained. There are people who get information from newspapers, and that information then disseminates through the traditional structures. There is no newspaper in Darfur. There's very little dissemination of cartoon-based newspapers in Darfur, and the distribution of newspapers throughout Sudan is fairly small in terms of numbers. So we have encouraged and helped to develop a genuinely Darfur-based newspaper. It's properly registered as a newspaper. It has a Darfurian and Sudanese editorial team. It is funded, and there is no particular editorial check on it other than to say that it needs to be generally supportive of peace and dialogue in Darfur. So that's the sort of main editorial line. But it does, for instance, carry articles from Abdul Wahid. It does carry discussions about what the movements are saying. It's not something that toes the government or the international community line. It is produced in a way that means it's visually attractive. So when it is distributed in the marketplaces or in Darfur, those people who read are actually attracted by what is this? It's not something they're used to seeing. So they pick it up. And we have seen through research and observation that this is then taken to people who can read, and they sit down and they start going through it. What does this say? And you actually do generate a debate, small areas of debate where small groups of people, those who can read, those who can't read, sit around a tree with a newspaper. One reads the articles and then they all talk about them. So it starts as a mechanism for starting the debate. Second thing we do is we do make radio programs. And those radio programs do present themselves with a problem. A lot of people will say, what you need to do to disseminate information in Darfur is to use radio. Well, you need to examine the way that radio is listened to in Darfur. It's essentially through two mechanisms. One, through the international Arabic-speaking services, like the BBC Arabic. Well, that is a generic radio program. It's not focused on Darfur or even on Sudan. And so the only way that you can get information to Darfurians through the BBC is to engage in a classic news management. You want to get the news. You want to get people interviewed. You need to make sure that Darfur is a news issue which is covered as a news issue by the BBC in Arabic. It's not a mechanism whereby you can place public service messages or very specifically organize debates or phone-ins or whatever. The only place that you can do that through is essentially through the three state radio stations, which are based in the three regional capitals of Fasha, Niala, and El Janina. And of course, they are state-run stations, and they are different in character because they're very autonomous, and some of them are much more sympathetic to carrying these messages than others. But in a large context, particularly with the IDPs, what these stations say is not necessarily trusted. The mechanism is not necessarily trusted because it is considered to be a state organism. So we can use that as much as we like, but we can't be necessarily sure that what we say on those radio programs is trusted. And so, how do you create a radio environment which is seen as independent and trusted? And of course, that's another set of circumstances, and it takes a lot longer in the context of the peace process to achieve than you want. Thirdly, there is direct engagement, and this is obviously feeding into the way that the traditional systems work. You talk to the native structures, to the tribal structures, and to the umdas, the sheikhs, etc. And you have like town hall meetings, consultations, as many direct contacts as you can to discuss these issues, and hope that they will then carry that message down. And I think it's very interesting to at that point to examine how Abdul Wahid was able to essentially communicate his messages much more effectively after the peace agreement was signed than those people who favoured the peace agreement. He was able, through technology, satellite phones, etc., to communicate to his political activists within the camps and on the ground, who were then able to take those messages and disseminate them through the traditional methods. So, again, it shows that there is an interface between technology and modern communications and how traditional societies get their message. One of the most striking things when you're in Darfur is to see somebody on a camel or a donkey in traditional dress surfing the web on his WAP phone, because they jump the technological divide very quickly. And you say, why would you put in, you know, wire networks, etc., into a place where you can just put in mobile phone networks? So the mobile network penetration in Darfur and in Sudan is very, very big. A lot of people have phones. A lot of people have mobile phones. They're relatively cheap, and people tend to use them. So mobile phones are a very important mechanism, which brings us on to how the diaspora actually has an impact upon this. Because the diaspora, as you know, in any of these circumstances, and those people who study Darfur, and I'm sure some of the people here, and probably contribute to some of the websites which are the diaspora-based websites, those have a very powerful influence on people on the ground. And one of the reasons is that people are able to get access to websites either through centres in the IDP camps or in some of the towns, but some of them even are able to do it on mobile phones directly. And, you know, it's not an uncommon sight to see somebody, you know, sitting on his, you know, looking at his mobile phone, actually accessing the web, not just taking text messages or telephones. So we have developed a mechanism. We're developing a mechanism where we actually put information on a website, which is not necessarily. I'm not trying to say that this is in any way surreptitious. I mean, we have created a mechanism in conjunction with Sudanese in order to carry messages through a website which aren't necessarily directly connected to the UN or to the African Union, so it's seen as an independent basket for that information. And this brings me on to the final area of discussion, which is something that we've carried put a lot of effort into, and that is the use of cultural techniques through the use of festivals, drama, music, etc. And we have run two consecutive years a big festival at the end of the Ramadan during the Eid holiday. We just last month, no, the month before last, we had the last one where we were able to bring. I mean, certainly in the first one, we were able to reach about 500,000 people. We were talking about putting shows on in the stadia at the end of a day in the main cities, and those football stadiums, some of them will take, and certainly the one in Nyala, took up to 20,000 people, and each time we had the concert in Nyala, not this time but last time, those stadiums were full. And that these concerts were the culmination of a day of activities, starting with small workshops, doing puppet shows for children, doing street theatre with interactive drama, with messaging based upon scenarios. I mean, I'm sure many of you are familiar with the way this works. You know, you paint a scenario, and then you freeze frame it, and then you bring people in from the audience to continue how that particular scenario finishes. And these scenarios are based around the specific areas which are most interest to the population, whether it be compensation, whether it be wealth sharing, whether it be power sharing, whether it be security issues, etc. This festival activity is based upon an NGO which was set up as a result of the success of the first festival that we ran, and was organic. This is not something that we as a consultancy have said, let's set up an NGO and attract some Sudanese guys to front it. This is, they saw this festival and they said, this is a good idea, we can use this mechanism, let us create our own NGO. And so the NGO is now the basis for the newspaper, all the cultural activity, and other the website, and the radio stream which has been produced on the website, and for the production of cassettes, which I didn't mention, but one of another ways of getting audio material to the population is through straight tape cassettes. I mean, most people who have radios have the radios with the flip-down cassette recorder in it. If they travel around the cities, they travel in taxis. Taxis have the cassette recorders, and buses between the towns also, play cassettes. And again, people like Abdul Wahid, in the early stages, distributed his speeches on cassettes. So it is a method that we know is used. So we are in the process of producing a magazine program, which includes the entertainment content from the music, from the drama, etc., as well as more discursive and news type programs on the basis of the issues. This NGO is called Afia Darfur, and it's actually been extended now by the people's enthusiasm to be Afia Sudan, because they feel that it has some relevance to the whole of Sudan. And the managing board of this NGO is made up of some of the most famous artistic names in Sudan, from Iqdil Jalad to Ali Mahdi and others who represent drama, theatre, music, etc. One of the interesting things about that is that it is also neutral. These people are not seen as politically motivated. They are as popular on the government side as they are on the IDP side. They transcend this divide, and so they can go into many of these circumstances and talk about things which anybody who is identified, albeit with the African Union, the UN, or the government, or even the movements themselves, can't. And so through this way, we've been able to dispel this myth that you can't go into the camps and talk about a given subject, because if people under the cover of Afia Darfur, and the cover is perhaps the wrong expression, you know what I mean, under the aegis of this mechanism, are able to go in, be welcomed, and talk about these issues in a much more frank and honest way than any of the organizations can do it. And at the same time, they're able to distribute the newspaper and other materials which they're identified with, which enable us to disseminate information much more effectively. And before I stop, because I think we're going to run out of speaking time, there is one other area which we never actually got into, but we will do, is that one of the problems with Abuja and the original Darfur peace agreement was the notion that the actual discussions were not transparent enough, that the people in Darfur didn't know what was actually happening on the ground, and that not only during the discussions but immediately afterwards, people didn't really understand what had happened. One of the other considerations is that the people that are only really being listened to as far as negotiations are concerned are the movements, i.e. the people who have guns. What about the vast majority of people in Darfur who don't have guns? What about civil society? So how do you bring in to the process civil society and give a voice to those people who don't have guns? And so this new process, there is a lot more emphasis being placed upon the consultation process, upon the direct outreach through meetings and consultations than was before. And this has been done principally through the Darfur dialogue and consultation process. If those of you who have seen the peace agreement and know that the DDDC was established as a means of enfranchising local opinion. Now, its principal role has changed slightly now. It's no longer, because of the situation with the DPA as it stands, but the DDDC as an institution is now being seen as the principal way of actually getting to civil society and getting civil society's views heard. And in doing that, we have sponsored with Annenberg, School of Communications at Pennsylvania University, and Oxford universities, a public opinion survey to try to get at what people really think, what they think the problems are, and what they think the issues are that need to be resolved. And it's produced some interesting, not necessarily surprising, but some interesting results. And that hopefully will continue. And it's part of the process of trying to feed into this process, what people actually feel on the ground, as well as giving them some direct input through a consultation process. But additionally, when the principal consultations start, in order to make people feel that they have a dog in the fight and that they are actually being consulted and informed, we have a mechanism of actually putting screens, you know, rather like the sort of World Cup or the, you know, the app that we put big screens in the marketplaces, and maybe have mobile film shows that go around and actually connect people directly to the negotiations, whether they be in Libya or whether they move to somewhere else, so that at the end of the day or the end of the week, depending on the dynamics of the negotiations, that people can actually be informed directly by the people who are involved about what's happening at the negotiations. And it won't necessarily be a two-way process directly, but they'll be expected to present to a diverse population in Darfur a summary of what the main issues are and where the negotiations are going. And then hopefully then there will be an ability for that their reaction to that to feed back into the process. Sadly, that didn't happen in the first phase of the process because it didn't last sufficient. But hopefully, when and if the substantive negotiations get off the ground again, and it's likely, I think, that they will do soon, perhaps in January, these are the sorts of things that we will be doing to try and bring people on the ground into the process. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Simon. We have a very expert audience here this morning, and we're looking forward to a very informed discussion. I would like to invite people who want to ask questions to proceed over to the microphone, and when you ask your question, identify yourself so we can capture your comments. And while people are hopefully moving into position to ask questions, I'd like to start by asking a context question. USIP has just completed a year-long study of the North-South peace process in Sudan, and Ambassador Carney, Tim Carney, who's over here about to ask the first question, has written a very excellent report on this called Some Assembly Required, and this report is on the table outside. But the question I have to start with are the sort of things that you've described as challenges in Darfur generic to Sudan? Or are there exceptional things about the Darfur Agreement that offers unique challenges?
I personally think that they are generic. I think that they're generic to those sorts of societies that have the same characteristics, in the sense that, I've just come from Afghanistan. I was in Afghanistan for just over a week before coming here to look at a similar situation there. And there, the ability, how do you communicate to traditional societies who don't necessarily get information from the ways that we do, the problems are very, very similar. And the relationship between the trust between the institutions that are there to implement activities and the feeling of the people on the ground as to whether they deserve to be trusted or not, these things are very similar. Mm-hmm. And actually I've spoken about this before in different contexts in terms of media development and infrastructure reform, is that people who have come from conflict societies and societies where they have essentially been under a central, strict and totalitarian type, if totalitarian is the right expression, but in a central run system, display the same characteristics if you are trying to make the system more plural and more widespread, and the reactions and characteristics to me are very similar in all these places.
Thanks. Let's proceed to our questions now. Would you identify yourself and ask your question?
Right, thanks. I'm Tim Carney. You've identified me as the author of a recent USIP report. It was a lot of fun going through 1,250 pages of interviews to try to figure out what happened in the negotiating phase of the comprehensive peace agreement and then the follow-on and still incomplete implementation. And that's what I'm going to take off of. I'm going to try to refocus the discussion on selling peace in Sudan by realizing the CPA, because frankly, I'll be a little provocative here, Darfur is a sideshow. The most important thing to realize in Sudan is the CPA for two reasons. One, it affects far more people than Darfur does. And two, it carries within itself the framework that can help solve all of the conflicts between the periphery in Sudan, not only Darfur, but also the Beja in the east and Nubia in the north and the center, the riverine Arabs that hold power in Khartoum. Now, let's see. The bottom line, as a result, is on the media side, how do you get the situation in Darfur to gel? It just isn't ripe. So what can you do as media? That's my first question. What can you do to help get a serious process underway? Now, if it is correct that we really need to sell the CPA, there are three vital questions that flow. And the first one is, what authority does one need to do media? Bob may recall that I ran the UN's Information Education Division in Cambodia when the UN actually conducted its very first election in the early 90s. We had the authority we needed by an agreement, the Paris Accords, among all of the Cambodian factions. What kind of authority does a serious media effort need in Sudan today, not only in Darfur, but certainly to affect the needed media information campaign in both the north and the south? Second, and I applaud your focus on the cultural in Darfur. It strikes me as just exactly one of the right ways in. But what you also need is a huge technical capability. And what that means is, if you're going to do market large screen TV, what kind of inverters do you need? What sort of battery systems do you need? How do you get out to some of these areas? Are you willing to put at risk K-sets? Do you need your own radio station, which we had in Cambodia? We broadcast 15 hours a day live on a radio transmitter that the UN controlled. Do you want to do AM? Do you want to do shortwave? Do you want to do both? Is FM a possibility? A little vulnerable because of its transmitters that are located. And finally, there's the big question. Who's going to give you the money? And how much money do you need? I had $7 million in Cambodia. That was more in the early 90s than it is now. But where's the money going to come from?
I mean, that's a very big question, and then we could spend the rest of the time just talking through all those things. So, I mean, I'll try to be brief, but I won't do them justice. I mean, firstly, yes, I mean, I agree entirely that the CPA is the center. And if we want to get into a philosophical discussion about how the international community approaches these problems, that's another argument, in the sense that I would argue entirely that we need to stop focusing on sideshows and trying to deal with specifics and look at the whole problem. And I think that doesn't just apply in Sudan, it applies to many other areas. You know, where do you start focusing before you, what you have to fix before the other things are going to be fixed? So, yes, I mean, I agree entirely that the CPA should be the focus in Sudan. And there is a great danger, as we've seen, that the CPA could unravel and is unraveling. I mean, not only... I mean, the SPLM recently have, they almost pulled out of the... They did pull out, they've now rejoined again. And there has been some UNDP projects suggested that a similar program should be done to that we're doing in Darfur behind the CPA. But, you know, to go to your last question, the resources that people are prepared to put behind it are just not... We were asked to put in a proposal to this UNDP project, to help explain the CPA to the south, in the south, particularly in the south, but also broadly and across the whole of Sudan. And we put in our proposal, and then were told at the end of it that they had $400,000 to spend. Well, I mean, it's a joke, and this has nothing to do with commercial consultancies. It's simply to do. I mean, we have in Darfur, in order to for program money, which is basically money donated directly into a program fund to spend directly on projects, we have $2 million. That's not in the personnel or the administrative side. That's what we have to spend, and you can argue that, you know, that is tight. So there are you're right, there needs to be a bigger focus and a broader picture, and people need to be serious about the resources that they're going to bear, and they never do. And, you know, and that, I was talking about this in other places I've been, is that, you know, considering the amount of money that you put into some military expenditure, and I'm not prejudiced against military expenditure, I mean, I was a soldier for a long time, when you consider the effects that you want to have, and the military talk a lot about effects-based programs, you know, what do we need to do to carry out an effect? Well, you know, putting an armored division against Fallujah costs a lot more than it does to run a television station for the whole of Iraq. And yet the impact, I would argue, is likely to be significantly greater in the latter rather than the former. In terms of what authority do we need in the media, well, this is a difficult subject to talk about. I mean, the UN have had problems. I don't think there's any problem in explaining that. In getting permission to operate radio, for instance, in Sudan, not just in Darfur. I think, and I may be wrong, but I'm correct in saying that the only reason that they can operate their radio station in the south is because that license, that agreement is given to them by the government in the south, not by the Khartoum-based government. At the moment, the UN have not been allowed to broadcast radio in the rest of the country on anything other than shortwave, and I'm not entirely sure whether they, they don't need permission for shortwave, but whether that that's seen as by the government as being a way of circumventing a permission. But essentially, that's the problem that I mentioned earlier as far as radio in Darfur is concerned. The only radio that actually is delivered is either the shortwave radio, which comes principally from the international operations, or from the local state radio, which is done on principally medium wave. There is clearly a need for radio, independent radio, in Darfur. I also think that there is a need for that radio to be independent in a more genuine sense. I don't agree, and this is another subject to discuss, whether the UN is actually necessarily the best people to put in the radio station. I think there are much better, I think the Congo example is a much better one, where the UN assisted the development of Radio Okapi, which is a much more locally based, focused, owned radio station than something that would be run by the UN. I think it's much better to establish an indigenous notion of local radio than it is to sort of have something interposed from outside. And I think there is a potential for that in Darfur, and I think the government are much more likely to feel comfortable with that. And not because they want to interfere with its editorial content, but because they are nervous about external, what they perceive to be external threats. So an indigenous-based radio station which is assisted by the international community and possibly by the UN would be very useful. But in the end, the UN operation, the UNAMID operation in Darfur, its ability to have the authority to do what you say depends upon the SOFA that it is able to negotiate with the government. And that still hasn't been done for the new mission, as far as I'm aware. As far as technical capacity is concerned, I've talked about that a bit about radio. As far as delivering television to large screens, I mean, that is not actually a particularly difficult technical thing to do. And we have the capacity and the capability to do that. It's not actually all that expensive either in the grand scheme of things. It is, of course, if you want to export that, you know, to the four corners of Darfur. And so therefore you have to make some judgments about, you know, where the main population centres are. And certainly we can do it in the four or five principal towns. And the idea of taking it to the rest of Darfur, the rural areas, is to try to re-establish the travelling cinemas, which was and always has been a mechanism in the past that was effective there, and it's been used effectively in other parts of Africa I was talking to somebody the other day who was talking about how it used to be done years ago in Afghanistan as a method of taking, you know, information to the Afghan rural community. The problem, of course, is that it requires a more benign security situation if you're going to start driving around Darfur in a truck with the film thing in the back of it. So, that depends upon the deployment of UNAMID and the success of the 26,000 troops who are supposed to be deploying. Thanks.
Before we take our next question, could I invite people who are standing in the back to come and fill up the many empty chairs we have on the other side of the room? It's much more comfortable, I think, if you're sitting rather than standing. And I'd like to appeal to the remainder of our questioners to ask a few short questions, because we want to get to everybody before we run out of time. So we'll look to you to set an example.
I will keep it as short as I can. I'm Ian Larson. I work here at USIP. First, I'd like to thank you for being here. I'm very happy to be having this level of substantive, serious dialogue about the importance and the relationship between communication and media and conflict in the peace process. And I think these are conversations that are increasingly taking place in the international community and thankfully here in Washington as well. Historically, I don't think that's been the case. But it strikes me that when I listen to these conversations, they almost always focused almost exclusively on structural issues and on issues of information channels. We talk about radio as a means to communicate a message. We talk about the internet. We talk about newspapers. We talk about traditional and cultural channels. But all of those, if we look back at what most people agree to be the definition of communication, which is Laswell's old definition of who says what to whom, through what channel, and with what effect, all of those issues are channel-based. It's what medium you are using to communicate your message. And I think we spend comparatively less time, at least in rooms like these and settings like these, to talk about the messages themselves and how those messages differ in different situations. And so I wonder if you could take a look for a moment at, I think perhaps the best way to look at that issue today is to perhaps compare and contrast how the messages themselves were different in your work in the Balkans versus your work in Sudan, and how you took into account culture and education levels, literacy, the various strategic issues, levels of media development and ownership, for example. And I'd also like to point out that I'm very thankful that you're talking about the cultural issue and having that level of cultural knowledge on the ground, but I also think that is at its core a channel issue more than a cultural issue. Theater is tantamount to television. It's what you're using to communicate your message, but it's not the message itself. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about those messages and the who, the what, and the whom.
Yeah, I mean, Libby will laugh because I always agree with people. So I'll start by saying that I'm going to agree with you, because I am talking about channels. Because as a technocrat, as a technician, you know, although I would argue that I need to have clarity on the messages and I need to be part of how those messages are developed, I'm not the creator of those messages. And this actually goes to actually a core problem. A core problem not just in Darfur, but in all the places that I've been and all the places that I'm likely to go, I think, and certainly looking at Afghanistan, I don't think there's any notion, is that it's not clear to anybody, really, at any stage, what the sort of strategic narrative is, and how that strategic narrative is then interpreted into the various messages that you need to deliver. Everybody is engrossed in the tactics. You know, they're looking, you know, the adversary, if that's the right way to describe it. You know, the audience, the other party in the agreement, what they're going to do next and how do we respond. And there's a lot of focus talked about tactics. But, you know, in terms of what the broad strategic messages should be, and what the broad strategic narrative in any one place is concerned, is actually quite difficult. And I mean, we can talk a lot about. I mean, when I was in Kosovo, for instance, I mean, we did a lot of work in trying to create a narrative as to what the international community was doing at the time, vis-a-vis, you know, the future status of Kosovo, which was, which is obviously the key issue, and still the key issue. And we came up with this notion, which was not just a communications notion; it was basically the agenda during the time I was there, which was garnered by this slogan, "Standards Before Status," which was a notion that that a place, a government, in order to have its future status taken seriously, had to show and display the characteristics of you know, essentially statehood, which meant that they needed to be able to demonstrate that they were capable of doing certain things in certain areas and demonstrate that. And therefore, that was then used in an attempt to try and get buy-in at every level into this notion that there were things that needed to be done. I mean, you know, I'm not suggesting for one minute it was necessarily successful, but it was certainly the narrative of the time. And I think that one of the problems has been in Darfur is the fact that that narrative has not been clear. It took some time, as I've indicated, to decide, you know, what the narrative was going to be surrounding the DPA. You know, was it going to be the basis of any future process? Was there going to be any acknowledgement that it had failed? Was it going to be renegotiated? And these are actually crucial issues to the sorts of things that we were trying to do. So I would argue that it's very difficult. You know, you can establish all these mechanisms and you can establish all these systems, but unless you have clarity of the political process, it's very difficult. Which takes me into something that I'm here talking about and trying to write about at the moment at Annenberg, is the whole business of strategic communications. It is not a separate issue. You know, public affairs, public diplomacy, whatever you want to call it, whatever the narrative is at the moment about this area, of which is a lot of discussion, as we all know, requires communications not to be necessarily have a communications technocrat in the room, but communications is part of politics, and what we're talking about here is politics. And you know, in a domestic society, politicians understand that absolutely instinctively, but they don't seem to apply that same rigor in other places. Now, of course, the messages that we are trying to reinforce in Darfur at the moment are broad, very big messages, and those are dialogue is preferable over conflict, that there is a process which people need to engage in, that people are better inside the tent talking than they are outside the tent, you know, not talking. All these sorts of messages. But that is, they to a certain extent are trying to create an overall a buzz or feeling, but they're not. I'm not clear, and we're not clear about what the precise, specific message is, because what you need to be able to do in support of a peace process there is to have very, very specific messages which are directed to very, very specific audiences. I mean, how are you dealing with, you know, each of the surrounding governments? I mean, what Libya, how Libya affects the situation, how Chad affects the situation, you know, how Uganda. I mean, you would, in a proper communication strategy, you would have messages which, you know, were delivered specifically to each of these target audiences. Which are the individual members of the movements? How do you address them? How do you send messages to those people? Not only how do you do that, what should those messages be? And this requires a lot more resource and a lot more effort than I think is currently put into these things. I still think that we're in the business that everybody appreciates communications, but thinks that what you do is you design your activities and then you call on your, you know, your public affairs, your public diplomacy, to go out like a marketing person and sell it. And I think it's a much more holistic process than that, and we don't do it in that way.
Thank you. In the interest of time, so we get the questions in, I want to take a couple of questions in a row, and then we'll ask you to respond. So we could have the next two questioners ask them seriatim.
Thank you. My name is Salah. I'm from Embassy of Sudan. Thank you very much, sir. Part of my question has been answered now, but I'll raise another question concerning the very important issue of the ownership of peace in Darfur. This is one way of doing that. We started this conflict. It started with one main group, then becoming three, and now the functions are over around 28 functions. So the ownership of peace in Darfur is very important. We've seen that the population of Darfur is now being taken hostage by these armed groups. They are not interested in peace. They didn't show up for many venues of peace. Coming back to the question of media, it's a very important role. You speak about an independent media, and some people are saying neutral, but if you have a media, you have to have a strategy or a vision in which you can go on to broadcast. That is very important. You have to have a peace in Darfur. This is a prerequisite for mobilization, because people will tend to, I'm not speculating, but will tend to see your role there as what type of peace you are advocating. what type of a framework whereby you can say or you can tell all the factions that you are advocating this message because of a peace agreement that says so and so and so, articles and all these things. This is still not there, and therefore we think the TBA is a basis for that. But also the DPA, after its signature, we think that many international and regional players have just backed up because the DPA is an international agreement brokered by regional and international forces. The government of Sudan was the first to sign, and then the others have signed. After that, we think there is a great mistake has been taken, that the factions are allowed to oppose. It's okay to oppose the DPA politically, that's okay. But when they declare that they are taking arms against the DPA, and the international community are silent about that, that is, they are not genuine about peace. I'm not speaking about the international community. They have did a super job in the work in the humanitarian arena, but in the political arena, they are sending wrong signals, and they are not conducive to peace in Darfur in general. Also, the implementation of the TPA is very important because most of the provisions of the DPA are echoed from the CPA. And now it's becoming, and even have another agreement in the East also based on that. The DPA has its own mechanisms of implementation. Unfortunately, both sides are defaulted on that, and the last report of the Evaluation Commission has clearly stated that. In most areas of conflict, most two parties have defaulted, and they need to seriously engage themselves again in this process, taking it forward, and then it will have its impact on Darfur. Thank you.
We have the next questioner as well.
My name is Ruben Benjamin, the Ghost Mission, the United States. I have actually about three questions, but the one has already been articulated by Ambassador Kony. The CPA is very important in this area of selling the peace to Darfur. This government or say the NCP, actually they are very adamant to the peace. They have their own calculations how the peace should come, contrary to the SPLM and the international community and the people of Sudan as a whole. The NCP will not survive if there is peace in the country. If there is war, yeah, this is actually where they can survive and move here. My question is here. Now in Juba, the SPLM and the GOS are trying their best to unify the Darfur factions so that they come to peace as people who have one goal. Contrary to the NCP, my friend has presented that government. They don't like that. They don't want people of Darfur to be united so that they come with one agenda, with one purpose. What do you think about the unification that's going on in Juba? The other one is the media. This government is actually not happy about the media. If there's media here that is threatening them, and it may root them out from ruling Sudan, from the power, and they are addicted to the pressure. They were addicted to pressure. When they are pressure, using the means of media, it's a threat to them. It's good that the media should be intensified so that people of Sudan would know the reality, because now they are not giving they are not enlightening people of Sudan or taking them towards the reality. They are just lying to people, and that is now making them still in the power. Simon, you have mentioned that we have rejoined the government of national unity. We're still talking. We will rejoin the government of national unity when our demands are met. Thank you very much.
Okay, what I'd like to do is ask Simon to respond to those two questions and then to sum up, and then we'll call it a day here. So thank you very much, and the floor is yours.
I'm not entirely sure where the questions were, to be honest, in there. I mean, I understand, I think there are two issues. I mean, one is, you know, what is the state of the media, and what does the media actually have, and what role does the media play? And I think there are some misunderstandings about when people talk about independent media. And I don't think that you have to wait for full peace and security to reign before you expect there to be what we would consider to be an independent media structure. I mean, in my experience and in conflict resolution studies, I think people would argue that an independent media has a big part to play in assisting with how that conflict can actually be ended. And I think that the point about you make about an independent media having gender is actually, if I understand you, is a little bit contradictory. I mean, the whole point of trying to get some form of independent outlet is so that you explore the issues and that the issues are presented in a way that enable people to have a serious debate about it. Now, I'm not trying to pretend for any minute that is an easy thing to do. And in lots of places where there have been attempts to produce that sort of media in the circumstances where there has been not that tradition, it's been quite difficult to do that, and it requires training and all sorts of things. But broadly speaking, it has also been successful in other places, and I think that if there was to be independent radio in Darfur, which was regulated through a regulatory system which is the sort of system that's recognized in most places in the world, I think it would be a useful contribution. I mean, I think that one of the problems in Darfur is that people do not have enough contact with information. And that is not just a question of people being frightened that they might get information, the wrong sort of information. At the moment, they don't get the opportunity to see the other side of either argument, and they're getting their information very, very directly through individuals and through mechanisms, broadly speaking, who have a particular agenda one way or the other. And the advantage of opening up the media and making it more independent, in my view, is that you give a better opportunity for people to have a broader access to what's going on. So I think it would be conducive to peace in Darfur, and I would think it would also benefit the government to consider how it can expand the use of radio, for example, in Darfur, just as they do in Khartoum. I mean, there are independent radio stations in Khartoum, like Mango, Radio Mango, etc., which are very, very well listened to, and which could be very, very powerful. Similar radio stations could be very powerful in Darfur. As far as what is happening in the unification is concerned, I mean, I think that is encouraging. I mean, my understanding is, I mean, there are some reports, and I've been a little bit out of contact over the last few days, but there were some reports that actually progress had been made in Juba, which was quite encouraging. And clearly, the unification of these groups is fundamental for the peace process to go forward. And that, again, I would argue, coming back to the reason why this what this discussion is about, we're not talking about the political process here, we're trying to talk about communications. And clearly it's extremely important in the context of what you were saying, to have the right sort of messages and the right sort of communication strategy which is focused on getting people to understand that they stand a better chance standing together and developing a negotiating position and being inside the tent than being outside it. And that clearly is a very important and sensible message. I think one of the difficulties has been that up until now, there has been a notion that we should be trying to create a common position, negotiating position, from a series of disparate groups, which if you consider that, it makes it extremely difficult to hold any form of negotiation, because if it's taken you a long time to negotiate a common position through a disparate bunch of groups, when you actually come to the negotiation phase, when you're required to give something or to compromise on something, it makes it very difficult for those people to change from that position. If you have a common position over 25 groups, when you go to negotiation, that's your position, and you can't change it without going back to 25 other groups. So clearly it's a very important aspect that these groups come together, and from a communications position it's extremely important that the message is made clear that for the sake of peace in Darfur, the groups have a duty and a responsibility to come together, settle their differences, and stand together so that they negotiate with the negotiating partners from a sensible position. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'd like to thank Simon Haslock for being with us this morning and for a really excellent presentation on a very important and sensitive subject. And I'd like to thank everyone in the audience for braving the icy streets and coming out to be with us. This is one of a series of programs at USIP on the role of media in post-conflict. There will be others, so watch the website. And I'd like to ask for a round of applause for our guests.